Hello, this is the Abstract Podcast, the podcast that takes the new scientific literature of small animal internal medicine to you. No fluff, no stress, just an easy way to catch up with what is new while you drive, exercise, or have breakfast.
We search PubMed every week and select the most clinically relevant highlights that were added this week. You then decide if you prefer to go and read the whole manuscript later. I am Sarah.
And I am Alex. We are AI-generated hosts, but the science discussed is grounded in PubMed. So this is the week from June 28th, 2026 to July 4th, 2026. Right, first up, we are heading to the Journal of Veterinary Internal Medicine, or JVIM. This is a very interesting case report.
This is from lead author Barton and colleagues in the UK. It's a case report titled Dietary Responsive Disseminated Eosinophilia in a Border Terrier.
So this was a 15-month-old border terrier with a 6-month history of recurrent acute GI signs and persistent marked eosinophilia. CT scans showed abdominal lymphadenomegaly, and biopsies confirmed eosinophilic infiltration in the lymph nodes, liver, and jejunum. No cause was found. The really interesting part is that the dog was successfully managed with dietary modification alone. They used a gluten-free hydrolyzed diet.
Well, it's an N of one, Alex. It's a single case report. We can't draw any broad conclusions from this. The association is temporal, not necessarily causal. It's a compelling observation, certainly. But it's just that, an observation.
I hear you, but the clinical takeaway is still there. In a young dog with eosinophilic GI signs and lymphadenopathy, after ruling out the usual suspects, parasites, neoplasia, a strict diet trial is a reasonable and non-invasive next step. It's a powerful reminder of how profound the gut-immune interaction can be.
Sticking with JV-IM, we have a retrospective case series on a rather nasty condition.
This is from lead author Ulal at the University of California, Davis in the USA. It looks at clinical features and outcomes of emphysematous cholecystitis in 35 dogs. That's gas in the gallbladder wall for those listening.
Yes, it's a retrospective review of cases from 4 referral hospitals between 2000 and 2024. The population was 35 dogs diagnosed via ultrasound or CT. The most common bacteria isolated were E. coli and Clostridium species.
And the outcomes are key here. The postoperative death rate for dogs that had a cholecystectomy was 29%. But what really caught my eye is that 11 of the 35 dogs were treated medically and survived to discharge. That's nearly a third of the cases avoiding surgery for a condition we often think of as a surgical emergency.
I'd be cautious with that interpretation. This is a retrospective study across 4 institutions over 2 decades. The criteria for choosing medical versus surgical management were not standardized and likely varied wildly. The sickest dogs probably went to surgery, which would skew the mortality rates. This is a classic selection bias.
That's a fair point, but it still suggests that for select, stable cases, perhaps with a lower gas burden or less systemic illness, empirical medical management can be a viable option. It's certainly food for thought.
Let's move on to veterinary radiology and ultrasound for a paper that really gets to the heart of diagnostic uncertainty.
This one is from Turner and colleagues at the University of Melbourne in Australia. It's a survey on inter- and intra-observer variations of the ultrasound assessment of dog pancreases.
Ah, yes. They had 104 veterinary radiologists and residents review 15 ultrasound images of canine pancreases. They assessed things like echogenicity, texture, and clinical interpretation. The results were not great. The average inter-observer agreement was poor, with a Krippendorf's alpha of 0.34.
Wow, that's low. So different radiologists looking at the same image came to different conclusions?
Precisely. They had the best agreement on things like echogenicity relative to mesenteric fat. But when it came to the actual clinical significance or the likely cause, the agreement was almost non-existent. The spin here is quite heavy, but the data are clear. The interpretation is highly subjective.
I hear you on the stats, Sarah, but in the field, this is still a step forward. Abdominal ultrasound is often our first-line, non-invasive tool for suspected pancreatitis. This study doesn't say ultrasound is useless. It just quantifies the subjectivity we all knew was there. It highlights the need for standardized criteria and probably reinforces the value of serial scans by the same operator to track changes.
All right, let's move to JAVMA, the Journal of the American Veterinary Medical Association. And this one is quite impressive in its scale.
This is by Oyamada and colleagues from Matsubara Animal Hospital in Japan. It's a retrospective study of 189 cats with 220 ureters that underwent ureteroneocystostomy for benign ureteral obstruction.
The population is indeed large for a single-center study. They reviewed cases from 2018 to 2024, analyzing outcomes for four different surgical techniques. Their overall perioperative mortality rate was only 0.5%, with a reobstruction rate of 8.5%. They also found that an extravesicular, side-to-side technique with tension-relieving methods reduced the risk of reobstruction.
Those are excellent numbers. For a procedure that can be quite challenging, a reobstruction rate under 10% is fantastic. The emphasis on tension-relieving techniques is a huge clinical pearl. When you're trying to reimplant a short, inflamed ureter into a thickened bladder wall, any little trick to reduce tension is a game changer.
The numbers are strong, I'll grant you that. But it is a retrospective from a single, likely very experienced, surgical center. The generalizability to a practitioner who performs this procedure less frequently might be limited. The absence of a standardized control group for the different techniques is also a weakness inherent to this type of study design. Staying with JAVMA, here's a paper on a classic ECC topic.
This is from Suarez Rodriguez and colleagues, looking at acute kidney injury, or AKI, in 106 dogs with gastric dilatation and volvulus, the GDV.
It's a retrospective review from 2013 to 2023. They found that nearly 19% of dogs with GDV had an AKI. Unsurprisingly, dogs with an AKI at any point had over 9 times greater odds of not surviving to discharge.
Right, that makes sense. GDV is a massive perfusion insult, and the kidneys are going to take a hit. What's clinically actionable here?
Well, the multivariable analysis is where it gets interesting. Preoperative lactate was associated with presenting with AKI. But for mortality, the two big factors were lowest mean arterial blood pressure during anesthesia and, get this, Hedistark infusion, which had an odds ratio of 4.
Hedistark? That's a big one. It has fallen out of favor in human medicine for years due to links with kidney injury. This adds more fuel to that fire in veterinary medicine.
It does, but we must be careful. This is a retrospective study. It's an association, not causation. It's entirely possible that Hedistark was given to the most severely shocked, unstable animals, the ones who were more likely to die anyway. It's a classic case of confounding by indication. I'm just not buying that Hedistark itself is the culprit without a prospective trial.
Okay, another one from JAVMA. This one is looking for a simple biomarker to differentiate two very common causes of chronic GI disease in dogs.
This is by Horita and colleagues from the University of Tokyo in Japan. It's a retrospective study aiming to see if red blood cell distribution width, or RDW, can help distinguish gastrointestinal lymphoma from chronic inflammatory enteropathy.
A noble goal. A cheap, widely available test from a standard CBC to help guide a workup would be fantastic. They looked at 56 dogs with lymphoma and 60 with inflammatory disease. They found that RDW was significantly higher in the lymphoma group.
Yes, but significantly is a slippery word. Let's look at the actual diagnostic performance. The area under the curve, the AUC, was only 0.63. A perfect test is 1, and a coin toss is 0.5, so it's only slightly better than flipping a coin. The odds ratio of 1.25 is also quite modest.
That does put a damper on it. But they also found that RDW was a prognostic indicator for lymphoma, with dogs having an RDW over 18.3% having a shorter survival time.
The prognostic value might be slightly more robust, but as a diagnostic tool, the conclusion that RDW may provide information when considering endoscopic biopsy is a bit of a stretch. The spin here is quite heavy. For a screening test, you'd want an AUC much closer to 0.8 or 9. This isn't it. Now for the American Journal of Veterinary Research, A-JV-R. This paper looks at coagulation in dogs with glucocorticoid excess.
This is from Koh and colleagues in a cross-sectional study. They compared coagulation patterns in dogs with Cushing's syndrome versus dogs on long-term prednisolone treatment using thromboelastography.
The study population was quite small. They had 8 control dogs, 12 with Cushing's, and 9 on prednisolone. The core finding was that both experimental groups were hypercoagulable compared to controls. However, the prednisolone group had uniquely faster clot formation kinetics, with significantly shorter R and K times.
That's a really interesting distinction. We lumped them together clinically as being at risk for thromboembolism, but this suggests the underlying mechanism or the immediacy of the risk might be different. A patient on high-dose steroids might form a clot faster than a dog with pituitary-dependent hyperadrenocorticism.
It's a thought-provoking finding, but let's not get ahead of ourselves. With an N of 9 and 12, these results are preliminary at best. The platelet count also showed opposing correlations between the two groups, which is strange. I think the conclusion that functional coagulation monitoring is needed to distinguish specific risks is sound, but we need much larger studies to confirm these patterns.
Now let's head over to the Journal of Small Animal Practice, JSAP. I really like this paper on a specific breed predisposition.
This is from Dainese and colleagues in Italy. It's a cross-sectional study titled Maine Coons and Intestinal Intussusception, Breed Predisposition and Clinicopathological Features.
They compared 371 sick Maine Coons to matched non-Maine Coon controls. Gastrointestinal diseases were more than twice as frequent in the Maine Coons. And here's the kicker. 18 of the Maine Coons had an intussusception versus none of the controls.
The prevalence ratio there is enormous. 37. That certainly suggests a strong predisposition. They also compared the intussuscepted Maine Coons to 12 non-Maine Coons with the same condition. The Maine Coons were younger, heavier, and more often had an idiopathic cause.
And they had lower hospital mortality, only 6% versus 42% in the other breeds. It seems like it's a different disease process in these cats, maybe a primary motility disorder rather than secondary to a mass or enteritis.
The data are compelling. The cross-sectional design is appropriate for investigating prevalence. My only question would be around the control matching. How do you perfectly match sick cats? There's always a risk of residual confounding. Still, the magnitude of the effect is so large that it's hard to ignore. It's a very strong signal. All right, we're into the other journals now. This one comes from the Canadian Veterinary Journal.
This is from Murphy and colleagues in Canada, and it's a case report that every ER vet should hear about. It describes using the lactate gap for diagnosis and monitoring of ethylene glycol intoxication.
The lactate gap?
Exactly. An 18-month-old dog presented with azotemia and a high anion gap. Critically, there was a marked discrepancy in lactate measurements between different analyzers. This gap is caused by glycoltylate, a metabolite of ethylene glycol, which can be misread as lactate by some blood gas analyzers. They used intermittent hemodialysis and continued until this lactate gap resolved.
Ah, right. So it's an artifact of the measurement method. That's clever. It's a diagnostic clue hiding in plain sight. But it is just a single case report.
Yes, but what a powerful one. It's a perfect example of using your equipment's limitations to your advantage. If you see a dog with an AKI and a sky-high lactate on your point-of-care machine that doesn't fit the clinical picture, run it on a reference lab analyzer. If there's a huge difference, ethylene glycol should jump to the top of your list. It's a brilliant, practical tip.
I concede it's a very clever application. But clinicians must know their specific analyzers. This effect isn't universal. One needs to validate that this gap actually occurs with their specific point-of-care machine before relying on it. Without that internal validation, it's just an interesting anecdote. We'll finish with a paper from Veterinary Medicine and Science on a very timely topic.
This comes from Vernley and colleagues in Liechtenstein. The title is Development and Physicochemical Stability of an Oral GS 441,524 Suspension for Weight-Adjusted Treatment of Feline Infectious Peritonitis.
FIP. A very hot topic indeed. So, with no authorized veterinary product available, clinicians often rely on unregulated products. This study aimed to develop a quality-assured 50 mg per mil oral suspension and test its stability.
And the results were good. They prepared 3 batches using a common compounding vehicle, Surspend, and tested them over 12 weeks at different temperatures, including a transport simulation. The drug concentration, pH, and density all remained within predefined acceptance limits.
So the compounded product is stable. That's an important first step. It provides a basis for veterinarians to compound this themselves or request it from a reputable pharmacy, which is a significant improvement over the black market.
Absolutely. It gives us a path toward a regulated, reliable, and accurately dosed oral treatment, which is what we desperately need for these cats.
I agree. However, we must be clear about what this paper is and what it is not. It's a physicochemical stability study. It does not assess bioavailability, pharmacokinetics, or, most importantly, clinical efficacy. Those are the crucial next steps. Proving a drug sits happily in a bottle is a world away from proving it works safely and effectively in a cat. That wraps up this week's literature. Please remember that an abstract-only appraisal cannot evaluate full methodology. The scope of this podcast is to provide a taster to stimulate your appetite to read the actual manuscripts of those papers that capture your interest.
Also, please note that we are AI-generated hosts and may occasionally get details wrong. It is ultimately your responsibility to double-check the veracity of the information, particularly if this is going to affect your clinical practice. Thanks for listening.